This is Movies, a podcast by The Active Cinema, and I'm on my voice memo app right now on my iPhone. So if you're hearing a quality difference, that's the reason why. We're going to get to the actual show in just a second. I wanted to give you all a heads up because this episode starts a little eerie in new context. This episode was recorded before it was made apparent to me that Buddy Duress passed away from cardiac arrest. And in this episode, you're going to hear us talking briefly about cardiac arrest and also how Hans and I are glad nobody has died from Mass State Lottery yet, and it won't be ending with an in memoriam sort of title card, which is unfortunately not going to be the case anymore. But just so you know, up front, these episodes were recorded in advance. I think I was informed of Buddy's death maybe about 48 hours after we had recorded this episode. So you're going to hear that. Very weird timing. And apologies for this opening warning.
Yeah. So I think my next pick, it's more of an appreciation other than one movie that needs to be mentioned, but I feel like the Police Academy series.
Ooh, that was on my list.
Should be mentioned.
Yeah.
Crime. The city was full of it.
Hey, free TV.
Desperate measures were needed.
I want you to go to the Police Academy.
The Police Academy is such a dangerous place.
Honey, don't worry.
Desperate measures were taken.
I'm joining the police force.
The mayor says we have to take this riffraff.
I'm trapped here?
Well, yes. We all are.
I don't think I ever have seen a single one from beginning to end. I would just always catch bits of them on TV over the years.
What about the cartoon, though?
I didn't even know there was a cartoon.
Oh, wow. Okay. So I have a completely different experience when it comes to like Police Academy, because at first my first thing was, hey, this 80s, I think it was 80s cartoon called cops are cool. And then it was like, oh wait, Police Academy, they can be goofy and they're just joking around about how their, I don't know, captain is kind of gay. That's cool, that's funny. Just to, you know, realize that that's not how life actually works.
But, you know, I love Tim Heidecker. I think Tim Heidecker is one of the funniest comedians who's been active for 10, 15 plus years. But he was on the Howie Mandel podcast not long ago talking about how Police Academy is an example of right-wing comedy in the 1980s. And I literally said aloud, I was like, what the fuck are you talking about? Police Academy is an example of right-wing comedy? Like, how soupy is your brain from all of the politics that you think, you look at Police Academy and think this is a right wing comedy?
Okay, so let's think. So the main characters are, you have a Jewish man. Yeah. you have a Jewish man and his best friend is a black man that's very good with voices. And then you have other teams of a little, almost midget, but not a midget. And psychopath that's got ginger hair, right, on Bobcat's character. So them two go together. Then you have Hightower, who's like the very tall black man, and a girl that's also very muscular and very demanding, and I think they were teaming up together. So a lot of it just, I don't know, it doesn't feel very liberal for me to think, oh yeah, this is the, you know, liberal cop show at all.
But I think if the general consensus of your film is that the cops are a bunch of fucking retards, that tends to be a left-leaning sentiment nowadays. You know, a lot more right-wing people could get on board with that.
They're cops.
I don't
that's the yeah, next the,
I mean, I guess I'd have to revisit them and watch them from beginning to end finally. But
I don't think any of like the actual police work gets taken seriously. Like, to me, it felt very, very much like, and maybe not a the comedy level as like a fuck, what is this movie called? God damn it, with the black guy and the cowboys. It's not a Blazing Saddles type of movie, yeah. But I feel like it's kind of trying to do that with the like how goofy the characters are. It could just be like propaganda of making the cops seem, you know, friendlier or whatever. But yeah, I can't imagine them doing anything like that now, especially making cops look goofy as opposed to making them look like Hitler. You know what I mean?
But also in the minds of people like Tim Heidecker, any movie where the problem isn't solved by a bureaucracy of women and gay people, it's right wing.
Well, it's funny you say that, Wolfman. I take it you haven't watched the conclusion of True Detective Night Country, have you?
I have not watched the introduction of True Detective Night Country. I have not watched one bit of it, and I never will.
The ending of True Detective Night Country, and I don't think I'm ruining the series for anybody by spoiling it, is a group of Native American women seize a plant of scientists and kill a bunch of men.
Faggots.
Wait, what?
There's Native cops? No. The cops are completely void of breaking. I mean, it's pretty good propaganda, if anything. You want to talk about that, True Detective Night Country, because they play it by the rules. They don't cross the line, but the Native women of this Alaskan town all band together and kill a plant of scientists that are all men.
Are they all white?
Maybe.
No Indians or Asians in there?
I don't think so. There might have been some Latino or some like half Native.
At least I at least appreciate scientists being butchered.
I was thinking that
TV show. I do like that. That's vaguely right wing coded. But yeah, I can't fully sign off on it, I'm afraid.
The whole ending was, oh, there's a germ in the water and it'll open up your mind and be able to see and do the you know, check it. And this is why like Russ Cole can see ghosts or something in season one. They try to explain that with science instead of
fuck,
spirituality.
Really?
Yes,
oh,
yeah.
No, they try to.
I mean, they already did. The reason he can do that is because he was a fucked up druggie when he was working undercover for narco. Mm-hmm. And they just gave it an even dumber.
Yeah. No, Wolfman, you don't want to care about things when they come out and you set it up properly. Why would you care about that when you can just change it 15 years later and make it worse?
When you can just take the hard work of talented men and rest on that as a launch pad, when you can start at third base acting like you hit a triple, and then even with all that, fucking blow it, because that's what they did.
Well, Nick Pizzolatto, I'll give him credit for being so petty and miserable and reposting everyone's criticism of the new season and talking about how they unfairly maligned season 2 and 3 and he deserves so much more credit. He was just reposting that on Instagram the whole time. So I like when there are glimpses of that authenticity, that realness every so often, because you never see that from industry plants, industry people.
I'm not surprised, just because of, I mean, I feel like this is a franchise that should just die. Just
like, here's what you do. Unless you can do another direct sequel season, right? Which you can't, apparently, because Cary Fukunaga tried to fuck of age women. Who cares? But that's a problem, I guess, is he tried to fuck some women he worked with a couple of times. Okay. And Woody Harrelson, maybe he's not in good graces because he had the anti-vax SNL cold open improvisation thing. Maybe. I don't know. We haven't seen him in a movie.
They are gearing up. They're pulling out all the stops to make it Trump's vaccine for the election. So maybe after this year, Woody Harrelson can work again.
That's right. After enough people die of cardiac arrest and they can't prevent the truth from coming out any longer, or cardiovascular issues, then it'll be
them,
the Trump vaccine.
You know, I'm one of those people that are going to die because of that, because I fucking needed to get shots to go shoot your fucking movie.
our movie, Hans. You're a producer. Sorry. You're not just the actor, okay? This was our movie. paying every, the toll.
Every time I see a video of like, oh, we just pulled this out of someone's arteries, I'm like, fucking massive.
It's just a handful of rubber bands they pulled out of somebody's heart.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just like, I can't believe I just killed myself by shooting these vaccines into my arm just so that I could just hang out with Loris and Jerry and Jake in Boston. That's the saddest thing, yeah. Yeah, so if I die anytime soon, is, you know, go watch Mass State Lottery somewhere.
I'm surprised nobody from the cast has died yet. There has been a lot that has happened for a lot of the cast members. Nobody's died yet, which is good. I'm very happy about that. There's not going to be an in memoriam. I mean, look, the movie's not out yet. There's still time, but there's hopefully not going to be an in memoriam to conclude the film. But yeah, no, that's not even something that you can like take pleasure in having missed out on. Like, haha, you guys were stupid. But it's just like, why? So 97% of the people are going to die of fucking heart problems or something. Like, yeah. Wolfman, did you, and I mean, this is your privacy if you want to keep it to yourself, but did you get the vax?
Fuck no.
Okay. Me either. I didn't either. All right. And I'm so glad I didn't. But,
and look, I said that with some pepper on it. I'm not holding anything against anyone that did, especially in the beginning. You know, nobody knew what was going on. There were some very scary videos coming out of China. I get it. But now, anyone pushing it now, go fuck yourself. But no, I did not get it. But now they're saying apparently that the fucking thing sheds. So even if you didn't get it, you're like, you're being exposed to it. It's somehow getting into your DNA.
Yeah, nice. Good. I felt like I was missing out.
I hope not. I hope that's not the case. Cause yeah, I was feeling like, you know, my blood's clean. But yeah, so far I know a lot of people that got it. I've got a friend who has myocarditis now. But other than him, so far I don't know anyone who's gotten a serious side effect yet. I fucking hope they're all spared.
Yeah. It's so much fun when, like, your dad dies because of complications, because of a stroke, and then you take this vaccine that apparently gives people strokes, because then it's just kind of like, okay, it's been 2 years since I've taken this vaccine. I'm hoping that it's still not going to affect me, but you don't really know.
Well, you picked a good time to get your health in order and lose a bunch of weight. I think you just upped your lifespan by about 5 years, I think, doing that. So I wouldn't worry too much.
I just don't hope they don't force me to get like a third or fourth one. Or
just stop sprinkling Takis on top of your beer and you'll be fine, Hans.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was our Police Academy commentary. Now they'd be forcing you to get the vax. Steve Guttenberg and Michael Winslow would be making cool noises while he pokes you with the jab, you know.
They need the money more than me, probably. So
I saw Steve Guttenberg in a commercial for a play on Broadway called Guttenberg with Josh Gad and the gay guy from Girls.
What's the play?
I don't know. It has nothing to do with Steve Guttenberg, but it's his name. So they were like, wouldn't it be cute if Steve Guttenberg tried to get into the play for free because it's his name? And then we said no. That was it. That was the commercial. Anyway,
things great? Isn't everything just wonderful?
Hey, remember Steve Guttenberg? Because that's where we're at now.
Hey, Police Academy, right? He was great in that for a couple of movies. I don't think he was in all of them either.
He quit halfway through. He was like, I've done enough of these. Maybe
I'm
I'll show
better
up for
than
a
this.
Scene.
He's like, no, you're
not. No, you're not. No, your career died after after that. He did Three Men and a Baby, Three Men and a Little Lady, and that was, we washed our hands of Guttenberg. We said, we've had enough.
It's rough for a Jewish mullet in the 90s. You know, there was a lot of them going around being leading men, but how many of those Jewish men mullets survived the 90s, right?
Who lasted? Who did it? I can't name one.
Jerry Seinfeld. I guess he made enough money, but he.
Well, he wasn't even really a guy in the 80s. He wasn't anyone till his sitcom.
Larry from Perfect Strangers, he didn't make it. He's not around.
Nope. It's really nobody. Did Tom Hanks have a mullet at some point? On Bosom Buddies?
The Burbs, maybe?
No, it wasn't mullety. I will say, not Jewish, but Michael Keaton had a very curly mullet for a little while.
I think he is Jewish.
In The Squeeze? No, Michael Keaton, he's like Irish.
I think he's both.
No.
I remember seeing like there was a Jewish parent in there. I don't think he's full.
Hold on a second.
Let's do the early life check on Wikipedia.
Hold on a second.
No.
Michael Douglas.
It's the Keaton Field boy. You know.
Was he our first Jewish Batman?
Don't even say it. Hold on a second.
Holy shit, dude.
Hold on. Early life.
I think he's got a parent in there who is.
Worked as an engineer surveyor. His mother.
The first circumcised.
Catholic family. His mother is of Irish descent, while his father was Scottish, Scotch-Irish, German, and English. Boom.
What about the grandparents? My Batman. Can we keep going back in the genealogy of Michael Keaton?
No. We've got enough.
Well, this is a very we've taken a very Mel Gibson turn. And speaking of cops, how about we talk about some bad cops, some good bad cops in Lethal Weapon?
He is a criminal's worst nightmare. A cop who enjoys the danger.
No guns, no jiu-jitsu, just bring him down.
Do you really want to jump?
Well, then that's fine with me. Come on.
Wait a minute.
He was ready to retire. Now, he's going to wish he had.
Gun!
Oh. Raj, meet your new partner.
New partner? Too old for this.
If these guys can just stand each other.
What you got in there?
Boy and Smith?
A lot of old timers carry those.
The bad guys don't stand a chance.
Don't kill anybody.
Don't tell anybody.
I'm too old for this.
The 1987 Richard Donner film, written by Shane Black. And I, you know, on X, I see a lot of division when it comes to Shane Black. I see people who are like, Shane Black rules, Shane Black can't do wrong. And then I see the contrarian. It's like the same crowd of people that are also very anti-Killers of the Flower Moon, which I don't understand that at all. It's like, oh, Shane Black sucks. He's a pedophile. Why is he always writing a kid in the movie? And it's like, hold on, you can't. All right, so you're going to question a guy just because he has a bunch of Christmas themes in every single film, and Christmas is a children's family holiday, you know? Anyway, what do you guys think about Shane Black as a screenwriter? He did a lot of work in the 1980s. I think he had something to do with, didn't he do like the story to the Goonies as well?
I don't know about that. I know he did, as far as I'm concerned, he had an almost perfect record until he did that shitty Predator movie. I think the biggest blemish on his record would be that he wrote the first script for Last Action Hero, which critically was a dud, but I love that movie. It's everybody loves Shaun of the Dead. Last Action Hero is Arnold Schwarzenegger's Shaun of the Dead. It's him and John McTiernan making fun of their whole careers. But even then, so Shane Black said that in the script for that, there wasn't a kid in it. And I'm like, how do you do that movie without the kid? Mm-hmm. That's the heart of the movie. So not a pedophile.
Yeah, I don't think he's. I think it's a ridiculous claim.
No,
for
that's
them
bullshit.
To make that stretch. And I think Lethal Weapon is a terrific film. I mean, he didn't direct it. I actually think he would be a great pick if Mel Gibson, for whatever reason, decides to not direct Lethal Weapon 5. With both of them as 90-year-old men, and I guess it'll just be like dragged across concrete. But his version of that for Warner Brothers, if he chooses not to direct that, I think Shane Black would be a terrific backup option of keeping it in the family, so to speak. And I have no idea what they could possibly do for that movie, but
he needs to redeem himself, because that Predator movie is still, and I say without hyperbole, I think that's the worst fucking like actual movie I've ever seen. Not counting like straight to Redbox stuff. Like wide release, full budget movie, god awful, and awful in a way to where like there's no excuse. Awful in a way where it was like, you can't blame this on the studio. You can't blame, like, everyone's at fault here. Which is crazy because it came right after The Nice Guys, which might be his best movie, which he wrote and directed. So I know that movie was too good for me to just give up on him. He needs another shot.
I completely agree. And I agree with The Nice Guys being his best film that he's directed anyway. Mm-hmm. He had such a prolific career as a screenwriter up until he did take the dive into directing with Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which was another Warner Brothers film. Hans, we had done a show previously on Lethal Weapon with Jerry. And honestly, all the films in the Lethal Weapon series are pretty good. I think the third one is maybe the worst. It comes around and gets a little bit better with the fourth, but at that point, it starts to suffer from what Miami Vice did, which is we're making one of the partners kind of redundant, and Danny Glover becomes less integral to the plot of the movie than he had been in the past, if I remember right. It's clearly the Mel Gibson show, just like how it turned into the Don Johnson show with that. But Joe Pesci is unbelievably annoying in these films, especially that third movie. I think he ruined it for me. I think the third one could have been a lot better without him.
I think Lethal Weapon 2 is a decent sequel, flaws and all. I actually agree with Kevin Smith, because I think it was him that made the point that once Riggs isn't crazy anymore, the movies don't work.
Mm-hmm.
And by Lethal Weapon 3, he's not crazy or suicidal. He's just goofy. And that does not work. He has to be a man on the edge for those movies to work.
I completely agree. I think that first one is just a perfect example of action adventure in the 1980s. And it might be the best buddy cop film of the 1980s. I'd really have to stew on that, but I think it's certainly up there and pretty timeless of a watch.
Agreed. That's one I always love putting on. You got a great villain performance from Gary Busey.
Oh yeah.
Who I'm, obviously a fan of. Mel's great in it. Danny Glover's great in it. That series gets interesting, especially the sequel, because you get a lot of like supporting actors who kind of went on to be in other movies. You got the guy who plays Uncle Hank in Lethal Weapon. He's one of like the supporting cops just at the station. Mm-hmm. I think he gets blown up.
You have Tom Atkins as Danny Glover's former partner who sells his daughter out.
Mm-hmm. You got Tom Atkins in there. You get, I forget the actor's name, but he's in a lot of Walter Hill movies. He just has a small role. He's the guy where they hold him still and they have him burn Mr. Joshua's hand to freak him out with the lighter. It's just cool. It's fun. It's very simple. But the action's a lot of fun, and you get kind of like an early, Mel Gibson is sort of like he kind of knows judo. He kind of knows jiu-jitsu. So you kind of get that, a little bit of that in there, which is fun. It's fun watching it now because some of it, I wouldn't even say it's sloppy. I think they're just trying to make it look good for the camera. Because a lot of that kind of fighting, when done properly, looks very fucking boring. And you have a great fight at the end where it's like, well, it needs to be raining, but we can't make it rain because it's Los Angeles. Have them run over a fire hydrant so that there's water just pouring on the fight, which I thought was a great little touch.
That's something you don't see as often these days. In the 1980s, they would try to factor in rain or water as often as possible. They'd slow it down a little bit. I think 8mm, that's not an 80s movie. It's a Joel Schumacher movie from 1999 or something like that. There's also a scene where it just starts abruptly raining in the cemetery when he's fighting the bad guy. Mm-hmm. In 9.5 weeks, they decide to run down an alley where they're making out in slow motion. And there's just water creeping down from the building that is not anywhere else in the scene, that's always a very nice touch, visually speaking. Wolfman, what do you have for your next selection here?
My next selection is 1986's The Mission.
Little in this world unfolds as we predict.
Who
Indeed, how could the Indians have supposed that the death of this unsung priest would bring among them a man whose life was to become inextricably intertwined with their own?
Tell them they must leave the mission.
They say it was the will of God that they came out of the jungle and built the mission. They don't understand why God has changed his mind.
Never become a priest.
But I am a priest and they need me.
If you die with blood on your hand, you betray everything we've done.
If might is right, and love has no place in the world.
Starring Jeremy Irons, Robert De Niro, directed by, I think his name is Roland Joffe. I've looked at his filmography. I haven't seen anything else that he's done. It looks like most of his other stuff is not very impressive. I know he was a producer on the infamously bad Super Mario Brothers movie with Bob Hoskins and John Leguizamo. But the mission, it's about, I think it's in the 18th century, and Jeremy Irons is a missionary who's like building this mission in the islands of South America, and he's like converting a lot of the natives. But they're having problems with a lot of like the local lords and landowners capturing these natives and using them for slave labor. One of the ways that they do this is that Robert De Niro's character, he's this mercenary, and he captures them and turns them in, and he gets paid money to kidnap these people and put them into slavery. He kills his brother in a duel over a woman, and the Jeremy Irons comes to him and basically offers him redemption if he'll give up being a mercenary and join the mission. And it's kind of about these two very different men and how they kind of approach their calling through this Jesuit mission. Another, you know, they're Jesuits, and that's a whole other JQ. I don't think the movie suffers from it. It's a very, in my opinion, it's a very beautiful movie. It's shot in all these like gorgeous locations in South America. They're like scaling these jungle mountains. Liam Neeson's got a small role in there. It's got a great score by Ennio Morricone. The script is written by Robert Bolt, who wrote The Bridge Over the River Kwai, Dr. Zhivago. Wrote like a lot of what else did he do? Or no, he did Lawrence of Arabia and Dr. Zhivago, not Bridge Over the River Kwai. A Man for All Seasons. He wrote The Bounty.
The Bounty was
Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah, The Bounty was one I watched last year, and I thought it was terrific. It had a great score. Great score to it.
But the movie is very tragic. It has an ending that a lot of people don't like. I do like it. Because I think I don't view it as a tragedy. I don't really want to spoil it, but I think that movie is about these two very different men, Jeremy Irons and Robert De Niro, basically kind of reconciling their natures with their faith, and ultimately kind of living that the best way they know how. Even if you're not a religious person, I think you could still enjoy the movie. It's very beautiful. It's very fun. I'm not fun in like a haha upbeat way, but like there's some good adventure toward the end. It's very harrowing. I think it's just like I think it's a gorgeous movie, and I think it's kind of slept on.
You know, I've never seen this film before. I've actually never even heard of it until you have brought it up here on the show, but I'm familiar with Roland Joffe from The Killing Fields. Another big movie from Warner Brothers in the 1980s. I will definitely have to take a look at this. It's the number one religious film of all time, according to the Church Times. So
okay.
How's that going?
More so than The Passion?
I guess so. I mean, who knows when they did that ranking? Maybe it was before, but
I mean, there is a great scene. It's probably the best scene in the movie, but it's when De Niro's character, when he first joins these missionaries, and they're going up to where the mission is, and it's up on the top of this mountain, and this mountain is steep as hell, It's slick from rainfall. It's muddy. Just walking up there on your own is hard enough, but he has decided that his penance is that he's going to drag all of his armor and his weapons up the mountain just in this net that's like tied to a rope that's tied around his body. And it keeps slowing him down, and the rope breaks and it falls halfway down the mountain, and he goes back for it. And there's a part where they stop and the other monks go to Jeremy Irons and they're like, listen, let him leave that stuff behind. Like, he served his penance. Like, it's enough. And he's like, I think it's enough too, but he doesn't think it's enough. And until he does, we're going to wait on him to carry that whole fucking thing up the mountain. And then there's this beautiful moment where he gets it to the top of the mountain and he's like crawling, and the natives see him and they go over and they see the weapons in it, and they just cut the rope and throw the shit off the cliff. And that is such a, to get a little whatever here, I think that is such a beautiful representation of what Christ's forgiveness is supposed to mean. But we don't need to get too deep into that.
No, I'm going to add this movie to my watch list and see if we can find it on streaming at some point. I might have come across this actually earlier. It is vaguely familiar to me. I just have not been made aware of this. This is also a Canon production. RIP Canon Films. Iconic Canon Film. That could be its own show. Canon in the 80s. Mm-hmm. We could talk about the Vacation series as a whole. I think that's definitely worth putting a spotlight on. I know you had made a reference to it either before we started recording or at the top of the show, Christmas Vacation and National Lampoon in general. We didn't really talk about it on the last show. I think it might have come up. You have the original, which was directed by Ivan Reitman, written by John Hughes. I think the sequel was done by Amy something, who directed Fast Times at Ridgemont High and seduced Chris Kattan, or Lauren Michaels said, hey, listen, you got to fuck this woman if you want that part in Night at the Roxbury, the movie, even though you've been playing that character on SNL for 4 years. You better seal the deal here, pal.
This summer, when you think vacation, think National Lampoon's Vacation. See the real America.
Hey, underpants. Hey, yellow.
It's friendly.
I'm okay. I'm okay.
Don't you want to look at the Grand Canyon?
It's educational.
It's great.
And most of all, it's fun.
The dog went on the picnic basket.
Let Chevy Chase. Beverly D'Angelo. Imogene Coca, Randy Quaid, John Candy, and Christie Brinkley.
Well, are you gonna go for it?
This is crazy, this is crazy, this is crazy.
Take you for a ride. This summer, when you think vacation, think National Lampoon's Vacation.
This summer, when you think vacation, watch out.
Carcone!
The Griswolds are going to Europe.
Hey, Dad, look. Bedpans.
This is your chance to travel the continent with them.
Will you please slow down? The kids are exhausted.
Honey, the closes in 15 minutes. There are 100,000 works of art to see. Come on!
Create your own ruins.
Venus, you're certainly,
Make new friends.
No harm done, yes. It doesn't really hurt much at all.
Visit distant relatives.
Well, there it is, kids. My motherland.
Dad, Grandma's from Chicago.
John Hughes, I think, also wrote that one. That one has a very fun, interesting opening sequence with passports and a game show. And you have, I think it's Eric Idle, or somebody plays the game show host and is like trying to make out with the very piggish replacement of a daughter for Audrey.
Yeah.
And then you have Christmas Vacation in 88 or 89, which a lot of people consider that the best one. I don't. I think it's the second worst, if I'm being transparent. Nothing beats that first one from my view, I think European Vacation is kind of slept on. It maybe it falls apart a bit in the second half, but there's a lot of fun gags in there and bits, and I think Chevy Chase is maybe almost at his best in that one.
Yeah,
I think I've ever seen European. I think I've only seen Christmas and Vegas.
You haven't? Hold on. Christmas and Vegas. What about the first one?
No. I think I've seen...
You're killing your microphone. Nobody can hear anything you're saying. Why are you a hiccup? How many drinks did you have tonight, Hans? Are you a lightweight now? What's going on? He unplugged his microphone.
Everything's falling apart over here. Hold on.
All right. Well, Wolfman, what is your history with the vacation films?
Christmas Vacation was big. I won't say it's big in my family. I don't know if it was this way with you guys, but I had a lot of extended family growing up, and each household had like a different set of movies that were big in that house. And anytime I would go over there, those are the movies we would watch. At one aunt and uncle's house and some cousins, Christmas Vacation was one of the big movies that we would watch all the time. So I grew up on that one. But I remember later I saw the original and then European, and then, yeah, I saw Vegas when it came out. Vegas Vacation I never liked at all. Christmas Vacation is a great Christmas film. I can't say it's a great comedy. It's still probably my favorite just because I love Christmas. But as far as the best comedy and pound for pound the most laughs, yeah, it's definitely the original.
I agree. I think the jokes in the original definitely hit the hardest out of any of those four movies. And I suppose we're not considering Cousin Eddie's Island Christmas Vacation part of the canon of the vacation movies.
The one that has the most jokes. Yeah.
They don't include it. I just looked at the Wikipedia for the series, and they don't include it in the proper chronology of the films. It has a spinoff. There's an asterisk next to it. And it's kind of a weird title in general. National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation 2, written by Maddie Simmons, which... Beware an adult man named Maddie.
I think the relevance has more to do with what is the Christmas... There's my hiccup. What's the Christmas movie that they're putting out that is like a yearly thing anymore? I don't think that's a thing anymore, even though it was for the 2010s. You had the Tim Allen movies, right? That was like a yearly thing.
No, it wasn't. There was like a 10-year gap between those movies.
No, but I think I get what Hans is saying, because even though they weren't releasing those every year, up until, I still think even well into the 2000s, there was still like a Christmas movie, it seemed like every year, that was decent enough that people would want to watch. Even something like, Love Actually. I remember that was huge when that came out. I don't remember the last Christmas movie I heard being made that went to theaters. This was years and years ago. I forget the name of it, but it starred Emilia Clarke and some Indian dude. And it was about Brexit. And everybody fucking hated it.
Jesus. Christmas is not even a thing anymore, right? That's why they don't do Christmas movies anymore, which is so sad.
They stopped pretending what they're really up to, and they hate Christmas and people who celebrate it. So they don't make those movies. But also, I will say, even someone who wanted to make a Christmas movie, a lot of people who celebrate Christmas are still fairly secular. And not to say that, a Christmas movie has to be religious, but nobody wants to see a cynical Christmas movie. Like, there has to be a level of sincerity. There has to be a level of heart that I feel like most modern filmmakers and even most modern audiences don't want or can't bring out of themselves.
Hans, would you say Mass State Lottery is a cynical Christmas movie?
I think it has some elements, like some Christmas elements, some wintry elements, definitely. I don't know how much Christmas, I think the move from... And I want to think maybe Elf. It's probably the biggest Christmas movie that was released in the United States in the past 20, 30 years, maybe.
Yeah. Mm, yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, like, what do you do now when you want to go see a Christmas movie in the theater? Like, I don't think that's a genre or a thing that happens anymore. And it's really silly because if you think about it, okay, so the concept of making a Christmas movie seems to be very simple, and like the elements that everyone knows work can be accomplished without needing, you know, very complicated visual effects or anything like that. So I wonder why, other than the culture moving away from Christmas, would be the reason why they don't make Christmas movies anymore. Because when it's, was the last time they got a?
If we're being real about it, it's because it's white. It's a white thing, and I a lot of the companies are like, you know, what I've heard from people in the industry, I've heard this from more than one person, is there's a phrase that goes around that is white and male or white and pale, or white and male is pale and stale, or some shit like that. So for the longest time now, they've been like, ah, we don't want that sort of colonialist consumer base. We got to get away from that. And now all the companies are hurting. So I think you're going to see withdrawing from, oh, fuck, maybe we shouldn't have geared everything towards black women or gay black guys or gay white guys who think they're black women, you know, trying to get away from that consumer base because maybe it's not as lucrative as what they had thought. So that's a big part. That's a massive part, actually. I don't know. I think it's just the people who spend money have to prove that that's what they want. Because if they prove that's what they want, then they'll make more of that. And it won't be Great American Family TV original with Candace Burr Cameron as the lead. It'll be something a little more quality driven.
Well, I think part of what's contributing to this is the Hallmark Christmas movie phenomenon that siphons off enough of the white woman energy. Like, enough of them are satisfied with that they won't stump for a real Christmas movie. Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of depletes a lot of the money and energy that would go to coming out to see a good Christmas movie in theaters. It's being deflated by that.
That's definitely something I wanted to mention. And I think I mentioned before we started recording, there is such a huge amount of population in the United States where you can be not aware of a type of content that gets millions of views. There's this podcast that I don't want to say I started paying attention to because I didn't, but it's this true crime podcast where you have like the typical very opinionated Nebraska white
Husker couple.
Yeah, and just a man that's just kind of there. He's a little chubby man. He likes true crime, but he's there. And then you look at their YouTube uploads, and all of their videos have like 2 or 3 million views on their content. And I'm just kind of like, holy shit. Okay, so people are interested in this type of content as long as it's softly and safely delivered to you, where I feel like maybe the reason why a lot of these movies are not done anymore is because the way that we consume content, it's a lot different than we used to anymore. So now any type of like ruffling feathers or any type of like, well, this character is kind of unlikable, it's not something that companies take risks on anymore. And instead it's just like, oh yeah, we're gonna talk about Eileen Wuornos, but I'm 40 and I haven't had a beer in 5 years, and my wife runs everything in my life, and she's the one that's gonna be talking about most of this episode. You know, that I feel like that kind of content, and it's something that we're not ever exposed to, but the fact that stuff like that is very popular and successful kind of brings me to the side of like, okay, so it's possible that maybe I'm not the target audience for this type of material, but the fact that everything is so sanitized and so like, oh, we're even going to remake something from the 80s, but we're going to remove any type of offensive shit. You know, we just want to make sure that everything is very safe and very Catholic and very non-controversial that then it just becomes being like, whatever, you know, like, well, I guess it'll make enough money because there's an audience for it, but who cares for this type of material, you know?
You know, on that note, we often talk about, oh, you couldn't do this comedy anymore. You couldn't do this type of movie anymore. Well, they did the vacation movies in the modern era in 2015 with John Francis Daly. It was a big hit. I just realized this is a big fucking hit movie. It made 3 times its budget back, which is, I wasn't aware of that. I thought this movie was a big old flop. No, this movie made more than 3 times its budget back, actually. But it was critically panned and they decided not to pursue any further sequels or remake. I mean, it falls into this category of it's a remake, but it's also a sequel to the original because they did usher out Chevy Chase and Beverly D'Angelo. And this was Chevy Chase when he was especially obese. And, you know, there were rumors he's in hospice. He's on death's door. He's going to die any day now, which turned out to be false. It's probably Dan Harmon who started those rumors, wishful thinking on his part. There's nothing really enjoyable to be found with that remake, in my opinion. Have either of you seen the vacation movie from 20, which does not bear the National Lampoon name, but from 2015?
I did not see it because it starred Ed Helms.
That's a good reason. Good reason to avoid it.
I think it's such a missed opportunity, especially considering that these two guys are on the surface very similar. You could even confuse them, although their screen presence is drastically different. The slam dunk would have been, if we're going to follow Rusty, you get Jason Sudeikis.
I think he would have been, I mean, depending on which Rusty you go with.
Yeah.
Then, he could definitely.
Jason Bateman,
I think, is a little more. You just get the whole Horrible Bosses cast.
Yeah, just get the horrible. Get Charlie Day.
They did get Charlie Day. Charlie Day is in there.
You keep recasting Russ with each of these new vacation movies like they did in the old movies. So then, yeah, we just get the 3 Horrible Bosses vacation movies.
I guess we're kind of missing the type of actor that hates the industry. I feel like there was a period of time where you would see that the actor kind of hates the type of movie that they're in and they're just kind of like, I'm better than this shit. Is that even a thing anymore? Like, I feel like actors that just get movies, they just like, well, you kind of have to upsell them at any time, right? So we're talking about Ed Helms vehicle, so fair enough. You know, this probably was not offered to a lot of better actors at Ed Helms, but I feel like, and I don't know if maybe low effort comedies is what I miss, but whenever you see an Ed Helms trying to act like Chevy Chase in the 80s, I'm just kind of like, no. Because I know that the things that were linked to Chevy Chase even being in that movie is not the same thing that Ed Helms got, or the reason why Ed Helms wanted to make this movie. 1,000%, I'm sure, is completely different. So the little bit of leeway that I can give them by just being like, well, I mean, Ed was goofy in The Office, right? Let's just give him a chance.
I don't think he deserves a chance anywhere, anytime. No. When he was on The Office, he was just doing Steve Carell light, you know? Yeah. So anyway, let's nudge aside vacation. I think we should talk about 2 final films here and then wrap up the show for the evening. The one that I wanted to get to, which I think is a good layup to what you wanted to talk about, Wolfman, to close out the show. I want to talk about Clean and Sober.
You took the money, didn't you?
It's real complicated.
We're talking about embezzlement here.
You guys know how many properties I sold last quarter? 23 properties.
Please tell security.
Me! By myself, for you, man!
Are you an addict, Daryl?
You don't even know you got a problem.
I just want to make sure I understand the deal as far as the confidentiality aspect is concerned.
A 21-day program which begins here in detox. I'll examine you, see what chemicals you've been using, prescribe medication.
Oh, great. Is that what I'm going to look like tomorrow?
Sleeping alone starts to get you down.
sometimes. I just know how tough it can be to have to sleep alone.
I'll bet you do.
Daryl, I've been through a lot.
You attracted to me?
Yeah.
You haven't been through nothing yet.
I want you out of here.
Fine! You want me out of here? I'm out of here! I'm gone!
I've been to about 9 million job interviews. I'm $52,000 in debt. And I got this chip. God knows what we got going next month.
From 1988. This is a Michael Keaton starring dramatic film, and it might be his best performance or one of his best performances. It's from Glenn Gordon Caron, who I don't know what the hell else this guy has done, but Michael Keaton plays a cokehead alcoholic who totally has his life out of order. He takes a bunch of money from the company he works from and tries to get out of it by, I think, going into rehab. Let me read the synopsis here. Hotshot real estate salesman Daryl has a bad cocaine habit. After embezzling his company's money, he wakes up next to a girl who overdosed. To hide from the police, he checks into a rehabilitation program guaranteeing anonymity. Under the mentorship of counselor Craig, and I think Craig is played by Morgan Freeman here, who's also pretty solid, Daryl accepts that he has a substance abuse problem. As he falls in love with his fellow patient Charlie, Daryl begins committing to a newly sober life. And this type of movie could very easily fall into the movie of the week, don't do drugs, drugs are bad, mold of the 1980s here. But it avoids that, and it kind of gives like a good portrayal of what this kind of fuck up would behave like in the 1980s, where it's like, oh, he's not only trying to get sober, he's also like forcing this relationship to happen with a very like Bull Dyke type of woman who has an abusive boyfriend, and this relationship doesn't work at all, and he's taking so much money from the company he works from. And Michael Keaton gives such a terrific performance. It almost feels like they put him in this movie just to prove to the incoming Batman audience, hey, this guy can actually act and he can do well. You know, trust in this man to play Batman. Have either of you seen Clean and Sober?
Yeah, I saw it a long time ago, because when I was a kid, I was very into Michael Keaton, and I probably saw it before I was old enough to really appreciate it. But I have seen it, and one of the things that makes him so great in that role, and I think it's one of the reasons why it doesn't have that kind of after school special feeling, is that Michael Keaton has such a great natural charisma, so that even though he's like a junkie and a fuck up, like you're instantly rooting for him. You want him to win. You want him to beat this thing. But he's always had that freak out ability, like the you want to get nuts, let's get nuts. But when you put that in a serious context and you see just how manic he is, and there's that one scene where he's like backing down the hallway and he's yelling at somebody and he's just drenched in sweat and he's freaking out, like, It is so like on the button, like that, just like withdrawal, fuck everybody, I'm on my own, addict behavior.
Well, your microphone's muted again. Damn, you! How many did you have before we got on air tonight?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
None. They've all been while we're recording. It's very impressive. no, it's just like I keep forgetting that my microphone has a little button.
You have dismantled your microphone like 3 or 4 times in the last 15 minutes. And Wolfman, maybe you heard this too. I don't know. Did Hans sound like he huffed helium?
He sounded okay. So I don't know if you guys could hear me laughing. But yeah, he's trying so hard to fight these hiccups that are in his throat that he sounded like Mr. Yeah. Plinkett for like 5 minutes there.
Yeah, you sounded like a sinister goblin a little bit, Hans, when you were talking about Vacation.
Listen, Christmas is very serious for me. it's just I've been trying to not let my setup on this computer is kind of not the best. So whenever things are happening, I try.
Your setup is fine. You just got to watch your hands. You keep pressing the button over and over and over. It's just a crutch. You need like a stress ball or something to just squeeze during the show to keep your hands off the mic.
I mean, anyone who knows me has to have seen it coming from a mile away. In my opinion, This is the crown jewel of this decade for Warner Brothers. It's Tim Burton's Batman by a mile.
Vicki Vale.
Hi. Bruce Wayne.
And what do you do for a living?
I'd like you to handle this operation personally. Me?
Nice outfit.
Hold on a second. I can't make it then either. I've got a very important meeting today.
Don't kill me! Don't kill me! Don't kill me, man! What are you?
I'm Batman.
Lieutenant, is there a 6-foot bat in Gotham City?
Alfred, let's go shopping.
Jack is dead, my friend. You can call me Joker.
I feel a little drunk. And you're not anything.
Hey, one drink and I'm flying.
Wing freak terrorizes. Wait till they get a load of me.
Yeah, Lorez, you and I have never talked about it together, but I've heard you talk about your love of Batman, how influential it has been on your life.
Absolutely, it has been. When I was 4, or maybe I was 3 years old, my uncle gifted me a VHS tape of the 1989 Batman film, and that was probably the most consequential gift that anyone has ever given me, because it inspired me to want to make films, to be interested in films. It was so rich with character and the set design and the costumes, and just everything about it made me very excited about art and the medium.
Yeah. It was the first movie I remember ever seeing, a first live action movie anyway, in theaters. My old man took me and my brother to see it. And yeah, it completely blew me away. I was obsessed with it, and I was never a comic book guy. Even through like most of my like kid, my childhood, my older brother was into comics, and I would occasionally look through them and try to read them. But the cover art was always so much better than the art in the thing that it would always pull me out of it when I opened the damn thing and tried to read it. So the movie Batman was Batman to me. So all the complaints from the comic book nerds, eat shit. No one cares. But yeah. And I talked about this on George's Film Journal. We did a whole episode on it. But it's the production design is so stunning. It's so unique. It's a world all on its own. The performances are incredible. The plot, the way it's scripted, it almost shouldn't work. Like from a structural standpoint, the Joker is technically the protagonist and Batman almost acts like the antagonist. But somehow it works. It's so operatic, romantic. It's fun, and yeah, there's just nothing like it. And especially in superhero movies now, it's they'll in my opinion they'll never top anything like this. It's the only Batman movie where Gotham City looks gothic, and where it looks big and tall. You know, in the Nolan movies, as much as there's a lot of good things to say about them, it just looks like Chicago.
Yeah. Well, the first movie, I think, Batman Begins has its own particular texture to it. And then he gives up on that entirely when he decides, I'm going to make Heat, but with Batman characters.
Yeah.
And then he could care less about that. Then you have Chicago and you have Wall Street.
Mm. But I mean, yeah, I could go on and on. So yeah, I'll give the floor over to you guys, because it's just a damn near perfect movie to me. And even now I watch it and just get an insane amount of enjoyment from it.
I think it's the perfect juxtaposition between commerce and art, where you have somebody who is at the helm, who is completely obsessed with stylization and wanting to put things that are not palatable to the public on paper into such a big four quadrant type of movie. And then you have sprinkles in there from Prince being on the soundtrack, which is you know, an indulgence of, oh God, who is the producer I'm thinking of here?
was it
John Peters or Peter Guber?
Yeah,
both of them. That duo of producing partners who owned the 80s and 90s until I guess John Peters tried to fuck Peter Guber's wife in a hot tub. That was the end of it.
That'll do it.
And John Peters is so rich with stories. He has a very brief appearance on the Joe Rogan Experience that I would recommend to everyone. He's talking the entire time. And for like an 80-year-old, out of shape, alcoholic, he's just rich with energy and has such interesting tales. But yeah, no, having you know, Tim Burton as the director here, with Jack Nicholson leading the film and Michael Keaton giving a very a very subdued performance as Batman, especially offsetting what people had experienced as Batman to this point with the Adam West television series. I think top to bottom, everything about this movie is a great example of what a film, and especially a commercial film, is supposed to be.
Definitely.
It's also, I think, one of the best representations of giving a director... I don't want to say carte blanche, because I know that he wanted to do some things that he couldn't get away with, but this movie, I feel like it has a lot of the feeling of it has a lot to do with Tim Burton's style, and just, I guess, going back to the Beetlejuice thing, I don't know or can't think of any 80s or early 90s director that could make a Batman movie and give it as much personality as Tim Burton did. As much as I dislike his latest movies, I feel like he was probably the perfect candidate to turn this, I guess, gothic character that lives in the dark into like a superhero movie that was not even a genre that existed when it came out. Mm-hmm. But he was able to come up with enough of a Batman, I guess, that even the comic book dorks would be happy with, and also people that we're not very familiar with. It doesn't get convoluted, or it doesn't get to a point where it's boring. So it's like a perfect balance of those two things that I feel like studios struggle so much with handling now, where it's like, how much can we go into the dork, nerdy online person that's going to care about very specific things, and how much can we just keep it to like general audiences? And this might be the one movie that balances everything so perfectly, where even if you don't know who Batman is or who the Joker is or who any of these characters are, you're still able to enjoy the movie without, you know, needing a backstory or a previous knowledge of what's going on for the movie happens.
Well, I think there's also a long history with this movie of what could have wound up being the film. And across the board, I think it's probably inferior results than what wound up being delivered. Things like the Bill Murray as Batman outcome, or Eddie Murphy applying to be a Robin, or even Marlon Wayans in the sequel being cast as Robin. The idea of maybe we'll try and get Robin Williams as bait for Joker as a backup to have Jack Nicholson finally sign the contract. I read that had it been up to Tim Burton, he wouldn't have cast Jack Nicholson. He wanted Brad Dourif as the Joker in this movie.
Dourif would make a great Joker, but not when you need the Joker to kind of lead your film.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that would have been if we
visually, I think he looks exactly like that Joker of the 1970s, 80s.
It just would have needed a better Batman, though, I think, because then you couldn't. Yeah, you couldn't have the Joker being your main character if it's not a Jack Nicholson-like performance. So Dourif would work as long as you have a stronger, I guess, Michael Keaton.
Then you get Bill Murray as Batman. Mm-hmm. The Bill Murray, Brad Dourif, Batman 89 could have really been something. With Tom Mankiewicz's script in play. Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think that would have worked. I think what we wound up getting was the best thing that could have come about from that. Mm-hmm. Wolfman is,
I think I'd rather see a Batman versus Chucky movie than a Brad Dourif playing the Joker, you know.
Well, wait long enough, Chucky will be public domain. That can happen. Batman's public domain in 9 years, so get ready for that. Wolfman, you could make a Batman movie or comic.
Well, I have an idea. Well, I've got one idea. It's not a Batman movie. It would be a movie about a regular homicide detective in Gotham City, who has to solve a string of murders while the Joker is busy fucking things up elsewhere in the city. So they're completely shoestring, understaffed. He's basically lone gunning it. And he has to solve these killings that nobody cares about. And then at the very end, he catches the killer and he's going to kill him. And then Batman shows up to stop him. And he has this big confrontation with him of basically telling him to fuck himself. And then the whole movie, you see that the cop is like this golden gloves boxer and he's this incredible badass. And then when he fights Batman for the privilege to kill this criminal, he can't even land a hit on him. And Batman just fucking kicks his ass. I have that idea, but I don't think anybody wants to make that movie.
Well, you could probably make that movie. I think I've just wait long enough and it's bound to happen because they're going to allow all these Winnie the Pooh blood and honey style sequels. There's nothing they can do about it unless, well, you know, they lobby to Congress. But
one thing I would like to see, don't make any more Batman movies or movies with Batman, you know, even if he shows up as a side character, no more Batman for at least 10 years. And then do a basically like the horror themed. I don't know what director you could get to do it, but basically the horror themed Batman trilogy where he goes up against Man-Bat, Clayface, and Killer Croc in any order you want. But it's basically the horror Batman trilogy. I think that's the only thing that we haven't seen, like the only kind of Batman movie that's still untapped.
Yeah, they do veer away from using those more heightened fantasy villains, I think, because the taste that the Schumacher films left in people's mouths were so pungent that they're apprehensive about that, and especially post-Christopher Nolan, where he said the vibe of, oh, it's the grounded reality of Batman. And it seems like maybe they're beginning to veer away from that with the... But I don't like the Robert Pattinson Batman, to be honest with you. I like the first hour or so of it, and then when it goes full QAnon terrorist attack, and it lost me as soon as they decided to take it out of the Batman movie it was existing in and try and appease whatever the X Reddit message board, we love Batman the animated series, Batman should be, remember the episode where Batman's sitting at the swing set with the little girl when she's about to die and holding her hand? Where's that Batman? Where's the Bat family? That fucking argument. I hate those people so much. I think they ruin the character every time. Like, if they had been given what they want, and they will be given what they want through James Gunn because they're doing a Brave and the Bold adaptation, you're going to see essentially a rehashed Schumacher-style Batman, but it's not going to be what that was at least like very confident in itself and earnest, even if it was a commercial cash grab. Hey, we got to sell some toys. We got to sell some Happy Meals to make up for Batman Returns scaring kids. We have to go in that direction. At least that was sincere in what it was doing. I think what you're going to get now is a very Guardians of the Galaxy tongue in cheek, like, haha, we're playing, you know, we understand it's a little campy, but don't you love that? Here's a quippy line. No. Marvel from 2012 shit.
No, everybody loves Michael Keaton Batman, and they may not admit this. It might be subconscious, but part of the reason why everyone loves him more than any other Batman is that he kills criminals, he throws them off of buildings, he blows them up with dynamite, and he fucks the leading lady in the first act of the first movie, which no superhero is allowed to do now.
Mm-hmm.
That's what people want from Batman. They don't want holding hands with a fucking little girl on a swing set in the middle of daytime. And another reason why they don't go after these bigger, more fantastical villains like Clayface and Killer Croc is because they know that the only way to do it is with practical effects. Because if you do that shit digitally, it's going to look like garbage and no one's going to care.
Did you see Suicide Squad by any chance?
I did not.
Okay. They have Killer Croc in that movie and they use practical effects. And I think he looks good.
Well, there you go. See? It can be done. Just put it in a better movie. And don't cram all those dudes in one movie. Give them their own movie.
I do like the idea of that being a trilogy of films. What were you going to say, Hans?
I think what we talked about years ago about how they should just focus on minor characters and like make their own movies will be a lot better than what we're getting now. Because so we're getting a new Superman. That's cool. We're getting a Joker that has been established, but now whatever worked for that Joker movie is going to be completely different now because we have the Lady Gaga character and we have to add a musical element to it where they're in love, which I couldn't give two shits about under that movie. I feel like we're at a point with DC where you can either be on the boat of, fuck it. Let's go ahead and do whatever the fuck you guys want. Or the thing that Wolfman's doing, which is just, I'm just not going to watch anything. And I don't think either of the two are good because I'm kind of in the middle of both things. Like, I'm kind of very annoyed as to what they decided to do with Joker. But at the same time, I'm kind of like, well, let's see. I hate musicals, but it's like, okay. So it's a different attempt of making a Joker movie. Fine. But I think it's so just calling James Gunn as like the head of it, the Zack Snyder of this universe now, right? I just don't think they should keep doing that type of movie. I feel like the universe thing is done, dusted, whatever. And just instead, if they were able to just do, you know, not even think about connecting anything, but instead using maybe lower DC characters in their movies might be good if they're able to get, you know, talented people making these movies as opposed to just who cares about this thing because it's the same as any other superhero movie. That might be interesting, but I don't know. I feel like I'm completely checked out with anything that has to do with superheroes, and it's all because of things that or decisions that studios have taken, not so much about like the movie that's actually being put out or the actors or the director or anything. It's more like, oh, I just don't care about where they say they're going with it. So why watch Aquaman 2? You know what I mean?
Yeah, and people still showed up for Aquaman 2. It just wasn't Americans showing up for it. Because as soon as that movie came out here, they were like, well, it flopped. All right, moving on. James Gunn, here you go. But then China and all the other countries were like, actually, we like Jason Momoa. We like Aquaman. We're not ready to say goodbye to the Zack Snyder universe yet. And that's going to complicate things because I feel like the interest around what James Gunn is doing with Superman, and Superman's always been, not always, we didn't talk about Superman on this special, but there were three Superman movies released in the 1980s, Superman 2. Technically, that is both Richard Donner's film and Richard Lester's film. There's different versions of it that exist out there. Superman 3, which spooked the hell out of me as a kid with that computer bad guy, the cyborg taking over the woman's face. God, that was
the mullet.
Frightening. Yeah. That was scary. Superman 4, The Quest for Peace, which is where Christopher Reeve got involved and was like, actually, I want the bad guy to be representative of nuclear energy, and we'll call him Nuclear Man.
And I'll tell you what, actually, the villain is a horse that just was being very goofy on a Wednesday.
That could have been a much better Superman 4. But I'll say people deride that movie. I don't think it's that bad. I don't think it's any worse than Superman 3. And Superman 3 is probably my favorite, or it was my favorite for the longest time. I decided to revisit all. What's that?
Is that the Richard Pryor one?
Yeah. Richard Pryor is Gus, the computer genius, the guy who shows up at the unemployment office and becomes a computer genius in 30 days. So
nice.
I think they're all pretty good movies, and I didn't appreciate them when I was younger because being inundated with that Tim Burton Batman and the Schumacher Batman, even, it's big, it's colorful, it's lively, and then you go to that, and it was big and colorful and lively for 1977 and 1980, but not for a 90s kid. For a 90s kid, you're used to watching Gushers commercials, and that's way more exciting than Superman.
Yeah.
So it kind of ruined things. Those Superman movies are still great. I recommend them to anybody. But there's been a problem with how you do a Superman movie since then. Superman Returns, very boring. Kevin Spacey is an excellent Lex Luthor, probably the best. Boring movie. Man of Steel, I think that's a great movie. I think it's a fantastic movie. Zack Snyder figured it out. Okay, great job. But now we're doing this again with a new guy, and a guy who looks exactly like Henry Cavill, but with maybe 6 or 7 years shaved off of him. You had something that people were very passionate about, to the point of harassing Warner Brothers executives to release a particular version of a movie that did turn out to be a hell of a lot better. Now you're doing this. I don't know. I'm not excited about it. I'll watch it when it goes to streaming or something, but I'm probably not going to be in the theater for it. And now today I'm reading that Warner Brothers, because they're hemorrhaging money, they don't know what to do. They're like, maybe we'll put Zack Snyder's Justice League out again. Maybe we'll put it in IMAX and we'll put out a Blu-ray of the black and white version, because they're just trying to recoup funds wherever they can. They're about to be on the same slope as Paramount, which is dead on the slab. And there might not be a future for Warner Brothers at this rate.
They should re-release Tim Burton Batman in theaters.
They should put it in run. 3D yeah. with new CG.
No, just take it as it is. Just put it out again.
We could have the digitally youthified Marlon Wayans finally inserted into the film in the horseback riding sequence that they cut.
Well, okay, so I'm actually glad you said that, because not that I think that this deep fake stuff is going to threaten filmmaking in any legitimate sense, but when digital effects already look so shitty, and that deep fake effects can look almost exactly the same, they're going to have to do something different. They're either going to have to get to the next phase of digital effects or go back to practical and get creative with how they shoot, because this boring shit that they keep putting in front of our faces is not going to cut it anymore when any fucking dipshit can do it on their computer.
That's absolutely right. That's something I've said for like 3 episodes now, including the podcast we're just on. But the being given the ability to do CG from nothing now, from text, and just you type in a prompt and suddenly you're going to get a car driving down Rainbow Road in Mario Kart, but it's going to look pretty legit. It's going to look as good as anything you'd find in a Warner Brothers or Disney produced film, if not maybe a little better. Then it's going to emphasize just how much quality there is in a human performance and humans actually doing stuff. And that's something we got with Top Gun in the sequel, even though it turned out to be a bunch of lies. They weren't actually flying those fucking planes. They lied to us, you know. But when you do see somebody do something for real, it matters much more. And you hang on that for longer. And so I think getting that authenticity is going to be much more emphasized going forward now, which is a good thing for movies.
Even me, like, rewatching 80s movies, I was just kind of like, fucking movies kind of just suck. I don't have the energy to, you know, sit down for 2 hours and watch any of this stuff. So when it comes to like superhero shit, I'm completely checked out. So maybe giving it to creative people or the interesting people might bring it back in, but I'm completely done when it comes to anything that has to do with superheroes.
I think if they did something great now, it would be wasted. Like the fatigue is set in with too many people. Like, and that's a big part of why Batman Begins was such a huge hit, was because there hadn't been a superhero movie in 10 years, because they'd worn out their welcome. And there hadn't been a Batman movie in 10 years. I guess, yeah. I think they'd done the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man. They'd done a couple X-Men movies, but it wasn't everywhere. And you could still go see a normal movie.
Well, their idea now is what? Let's bring back 60-year-old Robert Downey Jr. to be Iron Man again. Because, hey, that worked 20 years ago. And it's like, you guys fucking just, how are you even charging for a salary when this is the ideas that you come up with?
Let that man just have a few acting roles before he fucking dies or gets back on heroin. Like, he's got a brief window left. He's very much looking his age. Mm-hmm. Just let him be an actor again for a little while. Don't drag him back into this shit.
I don't think he's interested right now. I think it's going to take a couple of flops before he gets to that point where he signs a Marvel contract again. He was just bad-mouthing Marvel and how it killed his own credibility as an actor to do that role for 10, 15 years. So I hope not. I hope that's the end of it. I mean, he was Iron Man for 11 years. He did what? The Judge. He did The Judge in that time, otherwise.
Doolittle, right?
That was right after. He thought, okay, this is my next thing. Nope. Nobody wanted that.
That's on him. Mm-hmm. You don't get to bitch about having to be Iron Man and then just jump to a new franchise attempt.
Yeah.
Well, where you talk to animals, you don't think that's like a winning franchise to think about in 2016? Hey, I understand what that Poppy is saying. He's sad. You know, that's not a blockbuster 200 million movie.
No, it was a cute, charming idea in the 60s when they tried it the first time. And then in the 90s, you could get away with doing it with Eddie Murphy as the guy. And even that was kind of questionable. I don't think those movies were very good. But anyway, let's wrap up the show on that note. Detective Wolfman, thank you so much for joining us. I actually think we got two episodes out of this one. So it's going to be a three-part special. Batman was the perfect movie to conclude on, just as Warner Brothers concluded their decade with, they actually concluded it with, I think, Tequila Sunrise or Tango and Cash or some shitty movie like that. That should have been much better than what it was. But Batman was a big hit for 89 and for the decade, and it was one of the top grossing movies of that period. I think at the time it might have been the top grossing film of all time. I could be wrong about that. It was a $48 million budget, made $411 million back.
Boom.
So terrific success, and it changed the landscape for better and for worse. Probably mostly for worse. Just like the Nolan films, changed it for worse. You make the great movie, and everything it inspires fucking sucks and kills the industry.
Yep.
People ruin it. Yeah.
That's the yin and yang of things.
Enjoyment of the shit, yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, Wolfman, what would you like to promote before we close out?
Once again, if you don't already, follow me on Twitter at DET_Wolfman. Check out my rock and roll radio show On the Beat on SoundCloud, and check out my new show Bloody Pulp on Spotify. I'll have a new On the Beat dropping this weekend, and I'll have a new Bloody Pulp dropping next week with the man of the hour, Low Res Wonder Bread.
Excellent. Finally, I can't wait to promote that. Oh, one more thing on Batman 89 real quick. Avoid at all costs the sequel Batman 89 comic book that was released in 2021 or 2022, written by the scribe of the first movie, Sam Hamm. Okay? That is not Batman 89. That is just Sam Hamm's Batman. It's very 2020. I hate to even use the term sincerely, it's very woke. Don't read it. Don't buy into it. It's fraudulent. It's shit.
Ugh.
Okay? Go watch The Flash if you want the real thing. The Flash movie, not The Flash series, because they brought Alexander Knox in from the 89 universe before it was wiped out by some villain who was, as an actor, best known for being a slam ball player, if you remember slam ball.
Hey, Alexander Knox is the only journalist I trust these days.
All right, that has been Movies for This Week. Thank you for listening.